Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Mert, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Normally, I introduce myself with all of my names, and I think I'll do that for you just so you'll get an idea of what it used to be like. My name is Myrtle Lillian Allen Clary Sullivan, Dodge and Hyde and White Steel and Rump. I really enjoyed the Herb's talk last night. I knew I'd mess it up there. I related a lot to his story, only I never lost a car in my life, but I used to put husbands somewhere and go back and a week later and I couldn't find them. I lost a lot of those along the way. I want to thank the committee for inviting me, and it's been wonderful, and they did give me a very warm Georgia welcome last night. It was lovely, and I'm very grateful to be here, but then I'm grateful to be anywhere today. It's it's marvelous, really, to think how many people you didn't know yesterday that you know today and are your friends. Where in the world could we find this but Alcoholics Anonymous? I've done some traveling in the Far East and went to meetings, and I'm still corresponding with sober alcoholics over there. It's just like I'm home. You know, wherever I go, I just walk in the door and see the face, and I'm home. It was not that way the first time I walked in the door, however. But I'll tell you a little bit of what it used to be like. My parents were very fine people. They were not alcoholics. My mother would have made a good dictator had she been in that position. But she was a great disciplinarian, and I never liked discipline. I was born irritable, restless, and discontent. And why, I don't know, except that's just how I came out the chute, you know. And there was never enough of anything for me. I could never feel enough love. I couldn't feel enough of anything. And consequently, I was a very difficult child. And my brother and sister, I have one brother and one sister there who are older than I am. And they behaved like little saints all the time. I couldn't stand either one of them. And I was always in trouble, always, from birth on. And I never stopped being in trouble with my parents. And finally, my mother and I just about stopped speaking to each other for quite a number of years. And I didn't care for her. I loved her, but I didn't like her, and she certainly didn't like me or what I was doing. So my very first drunk was my older sister took me out with her boyfriend and got a bottle of sloe gin. I had never had a drink in my life. I was 13 years old, and they thought it was fun. They got me drunk. They got me drunk. I thought so for many years. And I was very, very ill. And I think I threw up a lot. I had a blackout. And my parents were going through a divorce at this time. And I always had to comb my mother's hair. She couldn't fix her own hair. And I was good doing her hair. And she was going to court that next day. And I was shaking and I was sick. And I felt wonderful. I felt grown up and mature, and I had done something she didn't know about. And I just thought it was great. And I didn't have another opportunity to drink until I was 16. And at the senior prom in my high school, the drummer who played in the band took a liking to me that night at the prom and invited me out. He was exactly twice my age, and I ran off with him and married him. But I was kind of looking for a place to go so I wouldn't have to go home again. I did not want to live at home with my mother, and especially without my father there anymore. And we had quite an exciting life for 2 years. I drank. He was away playing a lot. I traveled with him some. And then I became pregnant. and my first son was born, and 3 weeks later, it was over. I went to my father and his new wife to stay with them. And I behaved fairly well then, but I was restless, and I was irritable. And I couldn't find anything. My father kept saying, "Wouldn't it be nice if you had a job, honey?" And I said, "Oh, Daddy, you really think so?" I said, "What would I do? I don't know how to do anything." I was always this little helpless soul, that inside I was like a Mack truck, and outside I was this little China doll, you know, that couldn't do a thing. And I stayed that way for a lot of years, and it worked. Believe me, girls. Never let on how much you know or what you can do, because it doesn't pay. But I decided, my father had this friend who was a doctor, and he said, you know, that he would give me a job as his receptionist, and that was a nice job, so I said, okay. And I was only there about 2 weeks when I met this beautiful Air Force officer. And I thought, now that's what I've needed all along. He was from Alabama, and by the way, I'm a native Floridian. I was born and raised in Tampa, Florida, which there aren't many of us left down there. But I'm a third generation Floridian, too. And so I met this beautiful man, and he was very handsome, and I married him 5 weeks later. He was everything that I had ever dreamed a man could be. My father liked him, everybody liked him, and he was Southern, and that made it nice. And we partied a lot. Somehow I learned how to entertain, I learned to do a lot of things, and I drank. But I also got pregnant a lot. So I did something besides drink. I had 9 pregnancies in 9 years, and I have 3 living children. And I never drank much when I was pregnant. In fact, once I found out, I would quit. Now, not because I thought it was bad for me. I wasn't that bright. And they didn't talk about it then like they do today. But because I was already sick and I just didn't feel like it. It wasn't party time. I loved being pregnant. I thought I was the most beautiful human being in the world. The bigger I got, the better I felt. Now, you talk about crazy. I mean, you know. But I really thought that. I thought I was just gorgeous. And then after my 9th child was born, I had to have surgery. And all the doctors that knew everybody in town were kidding and saying, they were going to make a playpen out of a production center. And I took them literally. And I started to play. Well, I felt that nothing in my life was right. I was irritable, restless, discontent again. And I knew I couldn't have any more children. I just loved having them. I didn't care to raise them, you understand. I didn't quite know what to do with them once they got here. And I always had to have help. And my husband was getting rather boring, too. So I joined a little theater group, and I went to rehearsal when there wasn't one, and I went to cast parties when they weren't having them, and I would forget to come home. And alcohol took me where it usually takes people, way down spiritually, morally, every way. And I was not really a very good mother, although when I wasn't drunk, I was excellent, I understand. That's what my children say today. But this man finally got sick and tired of my running around, and I had already picked out the next husband anyway. He was sort of in the wings. I never got rid of one without having something there to hold on to. So after 16 years of marriage to him, Mr. Wright, I call this fellow because this one was really the right one, you know. And he didn't care how much I drank. I mean, he just thought I was wonderful and it was okay. And so I had no controls, no limits on me. And for the first time in my life, I became a very loyal, clean living, moral person. I didn't run around on this man, first time, first husband. And I really thought that was going to change my life. Well, it didn't change my life. My drinking escalated. I had no idea I was an alcoholic. And I just kept drinking and drinking and drinking. And the children were getting older and bigger. And this man put up with me. He would have made a fabulous Al-Anon, but he never got there. We used to come home from parties, and I'd always lay my head in his lap, and then I'd throw up on him immediately. So he got smart. He carried a blanket, and he'd put that across him and then lay me on that. He would bathe me. He would shampoo my long hair, towel dry, get me to bed. I mean, he took such good care of me that he almost took me to the grave, you know. He was just wonderful. And he, I'm sure, bless his heart, didn't know any better. But the children all left to go away to college, finally. One was already out of college and married. And I had two little granddaughters. And the other two were in college. And every time they would come home and bring friends, or I would try so hard, and I'd promise them I'd stay sober. And I would watch the clock, and I'd think I could have one, just one, before they get there. And I never was sober. I was drunk every time. So they stopped bringing anybody home. They were really disgusted with me. Finally, they were all away, and I told my husband, he says, "Why are you drinking so much?" He said, "It's getting really out of hand." And I said, "I can't help it. I have nothing to do. I have nobody that loves me, nobody that cares about me, nobody to take care of." He was gone to the office all day. And so he bought me a dog. And it was a little Shih Tzu. And it looked just like a dust mop without the handle. And I carried him in my purse all the time with his little feet. And I got so much attention. I love that dog. I mean, he was just my buddy. And I made a little person out of him. I rocked him to sleep. And he was my drinking buddy. Every morning when I got up or came to, I had Irish mist. That was my beginning of my morning in those days. And I gave him a bowl of Irish mist, and I had a cup full in a coffee cup that looked like I might be having coffee if somebody passed the house and happened to look in our windows, because nobody was coming over by this time. But the poor little thing, he would just lap it up. He loved the Irish mist. And then he would get his bowl and his teeth and bring it back to me, and I'd give him a little more. And then his little head would start to do this, and he would start foaming at the mouth. His little legs would go splat. And, oh, God, I would pick him up and hold him and rock him and say, "Honey, we can't tell anybody. There's something wrong with you, and they'll take you away from me." I mean, I was sick. So finally I started taking him to vets. I thought, this has got to end, because he did this every morning. I didn't understand it, but every morning that dog did the same thing. He had those funny fits. So I took him from vet to vet, and they said that he must have a separation from birth, a brain separation or something. I should have him put to sleep. Well, I'd run out in a storm and carry that dog with me. They weren't taking my baby away from me. So finally, we had a friend who was a vet in another town, and my husband suggested that I take him there. So I called Jack, and he said, "Sure, I'm going to keep him all weekend, though." Because he said, "I won't know, you know, about these unless I see him having one." So I took him on Friday, and he kept him all weekend. And I picked him up on Monday. He called me, and he said, "Mert, that dog was wonderful." Said he played hard all weekend. He didn't have any kind of a fit. He said, "Whatever's wrong with him, he's going to outgrow it." And, oh, I was so relieved. Oh, I brought that little guy home. Poor dog. And I thought, he has been so good. You know, he deserved a bowl of Irish mist. And I gave him a bowl, and in a few seconds, the little head was gone, and the mouth was foaming, and the legs went. And I just scooped him up, and I said, "Honey, we're not going to tell anybody about this. We'll just keep it to ourselves." And he had those until I got sober and he went to Aladog. And I'm very proud to say that he died sober. He was 9 years old. So, but that little dog, I don't know, he gave me something to do anyway. And I took up with a friend of ours that we knew real well. He was a much older man. He was kind of like a father to me, but he drank like I drank. So my husband left me. And I got sicker and sicker. And he only stayed gone a day the first time, a day and a night, and he came back. And then I had to go in the hospital. I was really ill now. I mean, my physical being, I was in so much pain, even the alcohol wasn't killing the pain. And I went to the hospital, and they did a liver biopsy on me and told me that I had cirrhosis of the liver. Bad. And the doctor had my husband and I come in his office. They kept me in the hospital 3 days as we were getting ready to go home. And he said, she will die if she drinks for another year. She can't possibly drink any longer. But he didn't have any solutions for me. I think doctors were grossly uneducated when it came to alcoholism in the past, and I hope it's improved today. But I said thank you very much, and my husband said thank you, and I'll take care of her and all this. And on the way home, I said, can we stop at Rembrandt's? That was a favorite cocktail lounge and restaurant, and have just one drink to celebrate my getting out of the hospital. I was dying for a drink. And he said, if you'll keep it down to one or two. Now, we were just told that I was going to die. And this is this man that's so good to me. Well, naturally, I had three doubles because it was the cocktail hour where they give you the doubles for the price of one, and finished the drunk at home. And that was the beginning of my end. My husband did leave, and he never came back. And my children all came home and tried to help me, and I refused their help. One thing that I never elaborate on when I tell my story, it is still very distressing to me, is I was hospitalized 19 times for suicide attempts. And I was I was a risk, needless to say. And I was so filled with self-loathing. And the children couldn't do anything with me. The husband was gone. There was nothing left. So I had my very last suicide attempt and was put in the hospital. And I lived, of course, and was shocked that I was going to be all right because of all the stuff I had taken. I thought it was enough to kill me. And I'd had bleeding ulcers off and on for a number of years, so I ordered my vodka by the case and my Maalox by the case, and I drank vodka and Maalox. Try it sometime, it's good. I was determined, I guess, to keep drinking. I don't know. I was really sick. But I, when I got out of the hospital this time, my sons, neither one were speaking to me anymore. My daughter was through. She didn't want to come home anymore. And I was really all alone, except for this old man that was a friend. And he and I decided to go traveling. He said, do you good to get away from here. You need to travel. Well, I was always so drunk. I was poured on airplanes and off. I know we went to see my mother in Florida once. But I was living in California all this time. And I don't really remember. I think I told her I was his companion. I don't know what I told her. But I got away with it, like I did everything all my life. And I don't remember a lot about our trips. We went a lot of places. But he drank, as I say, like I did. And finally, I got so ill in Lake Tahoe. We were up there. That was my last drunk. And I had a dog with me. And everybody knew the dog because I took him everywhere I went. And I lost control of all my bodily functions. And I began to swell all over. And it was a horrible feeling of demoralization, but I was also frightened. And in about 12 to 13 hours, I was so swollen, my eyes were like little slits, and I couldn't get clothes on or shoes on or anything. And I told him I thought we'd better head for home, because if I was going to die, I want to die at home. So I lived in near San Diego, and it should take one day to go to Tahoe and one day to come back. And it took three to get there for us, because I would drive mostly, and I would get so drunk I wouldn't know where we were going, and we'd have to stop and rest a while. And it was the same coming back, but I was in such terrible shape by the time we got back. And it was on April the 9th, 1977. And I didn't want to see him anymore. I was sick of him, because he wasn't going to help me. So Dog and I just shut ourselves up in the house, and I thought about it, and I thought, I need to go to church. You know, I had not been to church in many, many, many years. And I thought that's what I needed. That was going to really help me, because I was just about as far gone as I could go, and I knew it. So on Sunday morning, April the 10th, it was Easter Sunday, and I got all dressed up, and I think I had 12, 13 Bloody Marys, because I was trying to get up the courage to go to church. And there was a beautiful church that sat way up on a hill. I had never been there, but I'd seen it driving by. And I decided that's where I'd go. So Dog and I got in the car, and we went to church. And I immediately took Dog in with me. What else, you know? And that was the first thing they did that made me angry. They made me take the dog back out of the church. So I put him in the car, and I went back. Sat down and I listened, and they were singing, and I knew the song, and it made me so happy that I was there and that I knew the song they were singing. So as soon as they stopped, I started singing. And somebody came over and gently told me the song was over, and I waited, and they sang another song, and I knew that one. And as soon as they quit, I started singing. I just couldn't get with them. I couldn't do it while they were doing it, you know? It was awful, I guess. I mean, I didn't realize it was awful, but they did. And so this man escorted me out the door, and he said, he wanted to know where I lived and my phone number, and I thought, God, even in church, all he wants is to sleep with me. You know, I was so pretty about that time. You know, I'm sure everybody wanted to, and I look like, ugh. So I went home, and I locked myself, and I had gone to a liquor store the day before and bought several cases of scotch, bourbon, and vodka, just in case. I didn't want to run out. And that's one thing I never did in my life. I never had to search for a drink. I never had to wonder where it was coming from. I've never been broke in my life. I've never not been without a home. I've had everything that's supposed to make people happy, and I was never happy. Never. So I just sat in this room, my place, and with Dog. Now that Dog didn't get out either, and I don't remember a lot about that. But I know that I had been to psychiatrists, too. I'd been going seeing different psychiatrists since I was 20 years old. And when one would get to where I didn't like him, he was asking too many personal things, I'd leave him and get me another one. You know, I just didn't want him too close to me. And I was afraid of him, really. So consequently, they never helped me. But when I'd had my last suicide attempt, my internist had recommended a psychiatrist who treated children. And that's all he did was children. And I had been going to him off and on for about 2 years, or or a year and a half before I got sober. And he said that I called him. And it was 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was April the 18th. And I had been shut up with that dog in that place all that time, drinking. And somehow, I had a moment of clarity. And I lay my head on my dining room table and I said, oh God, please don't let me die drunk. Because I knew I was dying. I was throwing up blood and I was just real sick. And I couldn't pass out. I wanted to and I couldn't do it. And he said that I made a phone call to him. And he said he never heard such a plea for help in his life. And they got the police and an ambulance and came and got me. And they put me in the hospital. I was in a coma for 8 days. Now, what happened while I was at home, I don't know. But the staff at the hospital certainly loved to kid me. They said I had so much dried soap on my body that they could have washed the entire staff with it. I was trying to stay clean. I was always taking baths. God, I was trying to get clean. But that inside couldn't come clean. It just couldn't. But I was fastidiously clean. And I guess I was trying to do that while I was locked up in my home. I don't recall taking a bath, but I guess I tried. But when I came to from the coma, I had tubes in every orifice of my being. And I remember hearing words before I even opened my eyes. And I heard this male voice say, it's a miracle, she's going to make it. And it was my doctor. And there were three other doctors in the room. And you know, for just a few seconds, I was so grateful, and I was like I was euphoric for a few seconds. I was alive. I had never been grateful to be alive in my life. I had done everything to destroy my life. But I woke up. I came to that way in a state of absolute just joy at being alive. And of course, they didn't have a lot of treatment centers then, as they do today. And they kept me in the acute hospital until I was able to be moved. And then they put me in a neuropsychiatric hospital that had a wing for drug addicts, alcoholics, Alzheimer's, you name it, and I got on it. And the third thing on their list, we had therapy every morning, group therapy. It was most interesting. The third thing on their list for not drinking anymore was AA. First on their list was to change your career. Well, you know, my career had been getting married, and I didn't know if I wanted to change that yet or not. And the second thing was more exercise. And third was Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll never forget seeing that on that board as long as I live.
So right. He said, then we'll refund all your misery, take you back where we found you out on West Inwood Road, and you can start all over again with where you were. The logic, it was too quick for me. I couldn't argue, so I said, okay. So I kept on going to the meetings. And I believe that most...
When I look back and think, thank God I put that first. But I knew Lou Ann Sims. I don't know, some of you may have heard Lou speak. I had known her for quite a few years. We used to have lunch together, and she'd eat lunch and I'd drink mine. And I called her first to tell her where I was and what had happened to me. And she said, you have to call Chuck. You need to talk to him. And that's Chuck Chamberlain, that I called Papa. We all called him Papa. And I called him and told him what I had been through, and he was so happy. He really was. He said, honey, you're home. You've come home. And he had such a gentle way about him and his laugh, but he talked to me every day while I was there. He never missed a day, and he talked to me a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous.
because I knew he was in AA, and I knew Luann was in AA, and I had other friends that I used to be close to that were in AA that I no longer associated with much because I just drank. You know, I ran around with people that drank like I drank. And so he told me as soon as I was able and could get out, he would like me to come to Palm Springs, to the Roundup, Palm Springs Roundup. And he wanted me to come a couple days early so I could spend some time with him. So I stayed in there a while. I don't remember just how long. And anyway, I was 35 days sober when I went to my very first AA meeting. And I count the 8 days I was in a coma because I didn't drink, you see. The hospital arranged, they had a nurse who had been in that same neuropsychiatric hospital I was in, and they arranged for her to take me to an AA meeting on Sunday because I wasn't going to Palm Springs till Tuesday. And she picked me up and took me to my first meeting, and it was in a horrible neighborhood. It was in Escondido, California. And the place she took me was all kind of run down. It needed painting and all these old metal chairs. I mean, it was a mess. You know, it wasn't where I was used to going, the neighborhood, either. And I thought, oh, God, this isn't going to work for me. So I went in, and I sat down, and I didn't hear anything that whole meeting except one line. It says, if you want what we have. And I didn't see a soul in there that had a darn thing I wanted. I mean, I just didn't. I sat there and criticized in my own mind everybody there. They weren't dressed right. They didn't speak right. They didn't look right. Nothing about them was right. These weren't my kind of people. Now, I don't really know what my kind of people were, but I judged those people. I really did. And we had one old fellow from Oklahoma, and he used to always say, I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, why doesn't he learn English? You know, I mean, just things like that. And yet those people were so good to me. Oh. And they put their arm around me and said, you just keep coming back. Let us love you till you can love yourself. And I thought, them? So I went straight home, called Papa. And I said, I can't go to the meetings here. I said, they aren't my kind of people. And I said, I need to be in Laguna or Newport Beach, you know. That's more my kind of people. And he said, honey, you've got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I don't want you to look at the people. You don't have to even talk to the people, but I want you to learn to listen to their feelings. He said, they may look nothing like you, may not have come from where you've come from, but they feel the same way you feel. And you need to get a sponsor. So Luann was my first sponsor. But she lived in L.A. and I was in San Diego, so it wasn't working too good. And she said, I want you to get one there also. So I picked this little lady out who was probably old enough to be my mother. She was 5 years sober, and she had a mouth like a sailor. And it's the truth. I have never been one for profanity. I never grew up with it. I never used profanity. I was not a bar drinker, and I hate that. I regret that I wasn't, because I could have met so many of you beautiful men in the bar. But I was really a home drunk, is what I was. So I never picked up the street talk. And those people in those meetings out there, my word, I learned all kinds of four-letter words. In fact, they presented me with a big plaque in old English lettering at a meeting once. And it said P-H-U-Q-U-E. And they had me announce it from the podium. And everybody just clapped like crazy because I finally said the dirty word. And I have learned to use a lot of them, you know, in AA. And I do it real well, and I enjoy it. But You know, I'm really not a prude at all, but I just didn't grow up that way, and I never learned to do it. So I was appalled at the language. I really was. And they were all taking bets on me that I wasn't going to make it and calling me all kinds of names, and I wasn't real popular. They were making fun of me, really, is what they were doing, but they were loving me at the same time. And I went to the Palm Springs thing, and these people were happy and laughing and cutting up, and I just knew. I knew they were on something that I couldn't smell. And I wanted some of it, because I was real inhibited there. I didn't feel comfortable. I just kept watching people. And, of course, Papa and Luann kept telling everybody, she's new, she's new, isn't it wonderful, she's come home to us, she's new. And I got so much attention for about a year that lasted. And then everybody forgot I existed, you know, and that was kind of heartbreaking, but I didn't want it. It wasn't heartbreaking enough for me to go out and pick up again, I assure you. When I was sober about, I guess, maybe 5 months, I went to my first AA dance. And this handsome man came over and asked me to dance. Do you know I had not danced since high school except drinking? I didn't even know what to do. And he just said he would make it easy for me, and he just took me in his arms, honey, and we just glided around. It was wonderful. And about 3 weeks later, he asked me to marry him. And I had only been divorced about 8 months. And I thought, God, that's what's missing. I don't have anybody to take trash out. I don't have anybody to walk the dog. Nor anybody to sleep with. I mean, you know, my life is pretty blah. And so I said I'd have to think about it. So about 2 weeks, he gave me a couple weeks, and then he said, you know, there's a boat I found I'd love to buy. And he said, we could have so much fun. We could do this with the boat and go away weekends on the boat and that with the boat. And he said, why don't we buy it? He said, if you'll loan me the money. Well, it was only $13,000. And I loaned him the money. He said he would put it in my name. Well, I believed him, and I got to go out in the boat once, and it was real nice. I owned a beautiful boat, I thought. And 2 weeks later, I finally decided I should marry him. So I did. And he was always waiting for this big windfall, you know, to come. And he was going to pay me back. And I learned more about him the week we were married. I paid for the honeymoon in Laguna Beach and everything else. And I found out he was looking for a home, you know, and somebody to take care of him. And that wasn't quite my M.O. You know, I'm the one that gets taken care of, sweetheart. You better believe it. And this guy wasn't doing it worth, you know. So I kicked him out. It lasted we were actually married 2 weeks. And that was my shortest marriage. You know. But thank God I had sense enough to get out of that. You know, in the old days I was drinking, I'd probably stay till he absolutely broke me. Anyway, I got rid of him, and there was another man I had met when I really the first few weeks I went to meetings, and he walked in one day and he patted me on the head and he said, little girl, when you grow up, I'm going to marry you. He meant in the program. He certainly didn't mean in years. God, I was an old lady when I got here. But he was super. And I thought he was much too old for me. I was sort of in the young then. And, you know, I vacillated back and forth. But, my 17-year husband before the two-week one was... the one that took such good care of me was quite a lot younger than I was, and he had never been married before, and he was really quite nice, so I didn't look at older men as being too interesting. And I went to meetings. I went to a lot of meetings. Of course, this man was, I knew which meetings he went to too, and I always went to those because he was interesting. And I averaged a little over 700 meetings the first year I was sober. I lived in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to get right in people's faces and I'd say, I'm alive. And I'd smile at them and I think they thought I was nuts. But they were all alcoholics, so they understood, you know. But I couldn't feel the joy of sobriety that first year. All I felt was joy in being alive. And yet I knew I was done drinking. I knew that. It was no struggle at all. I had no desire for a drink. And the first thing I ever remembered seeing in that big book was a little tiny sentence. And I'm not a page quoter. I don't know where anything is. Yeah, I know it's all there, though. To drink is to die. And I remember that just real strong in my mind. But I went to my meetings and I was 11. My sponsor didn't let me talk either. I could not talk. In California, they have a funny thing about talking. It may be different today, I don't know, but you weren't allowed to say anything. And I said, well, why can't I talk and share? She said, honey, you give them your name, say you're grateful to be here, that you're an alcoholic, and you shut up. She said, you learn to listen. And she said, that is all you know, is your name and that you're an alcoholic. You don't know anything else. And you don't have anything anybody wants. Don't forget that either. So I took that to heart and believed her. And I just didn't share at all. I was probably about 8 months sober when I started to talk, and I haven't shut up since. But this little girl asked me to be her sponsor before I was a year sober. And I went to my sponsor. I said, I can't do that. I'm so busy working on myself. I can't be bothered with that kid. I don't want her. And then I got the little speech about, if you don't give it away, you can't keep it. And I kind of thought about that, and of course she called me a few names like self-centered, selfish. You know, they weren't real kind to you, the people that sponsored you out there. They didn't mince words with you, and thank God, because I needed that. I needed it so badly. And I did take the little girl on, and I did become her sponsor, and I had her for quite a few years. But then I started sponsoring other people. I got involved. I became a volunteer at Central Office. And my life began to change. It was so exciting. It still is to me. When I wake up every morning, and we live where there are a lot of trees and birds singing and all, and I hear that sound, I'm so grateful I can hear it. So many years, so much of my life, everything went unnoticed. You know, I just didn't notice things. And today the gifts of nature and life are so wonderful. And it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God that I can even imagine these things happening to me. And they happen on a daily basis. It's just wonderful. But I got really involved in AA. But this gentleman still was coming around, and he finally invited me out for dinner, and I wasn't quite a year sober yet, and he asked me to marry him after 4 dates, and I didn't think too much. I said yes, I would, and we did wait till the spring, but we did get married. And it was my very first real sober marriage. And it was wonderful. I learned so much from this man. He was 16 years sober when we got married. And I was a little over one. And he was a writer. And also a movie producer. And he wrote over 100 songs, as well as many comedies that most of you grew up on. And he had been very successful. But he had a gentleness about him that I had never known. And he taught me about trust. And he taught me to love is like this, not like this. And there were just so many things that I'm very grateful for. And then he became ill, and they had to amputate his legs. And of course, he was a comedy writer, so he made jokes. He used to tell all the nurses that this poor little girl here married this 6'4" man, and now she's stuck with this 4'6" man. And those kinds of, he kept a sense of humor. It never went away. And I moved into Scripps Hospital with him and spent his last days with him, and he died. And I am so grateful today that I had him in my life. I truly am. I wasn't as eager, even to date. It just didn't seem important to me anymore. And I had a very long period of time to do some growing in. I threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous, literally. I didn't work, and haven't worked since I've been sober, really. I work a lot, but it's not the kind you get money for. I get to stay sober for it, and that's even better than money. So I started sponsoring a lot of women and working on conventions and roundups and still worked at central office. I never gave that up, half a day a week. And I had never, ever, the steps I went from 1 through 12 with a sponsor. In fact, I did 2 fourth and fifth steps because the first one I was too sick. I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't sober long enough. The second one I did at 3 years when my head was much clearer and my mind had been restored. But after my husband died, I wanted to move back to Florida. I was still in California, and I had never really made peace with my mother. And there was just a gnawing there in me that I felt I just needed to be with her. I didn't know how it would work out or anything. But I was 7 years sober, and I knew that I had changed. Even if she hadn't, it had nothing to do with it. I understood that. And my sponsor made me wait a year before coming back because she wanted me to go through 4 seasons of grief, which I did. And then packed up my huge household of stuff, piano and all, and moved it to Florida. And I didn't want to move to the coast where my mother lived and where I had lived at one time drinking because there were so many drinking friends still there. And I wasn't sure how I was going to be with her, so I moved to Orlando. I'd never lived in Orlando in my life. And I was lonely, very lonely for a while. But I started acting. I kept calling California. I'd say, what shall I do? What shall I do? It was 1984, February, the end of February I moved here. And they said, act like a newcomer. Keep going to meetings, put your hand out, go down to their central office, get something to do, get involved. Don't isolate because you're lonely. And I probably didn't stay lonely more than 6 weeks. It was all gone. I was at home and busy. And my mother and I became very, very close friends. She lived almost 7 years after I came back, and she just died last January. And we loved each other, and it was great. So God has such a sneaky way of having us heal wounds. I had no idea how deep my wound went with my mother, but the joy that I had with her was priceless. And I'm grateful for that. My children, God bless them, they are all happy their mother is sober. Believe me, I've often heard people say that their children didn't know they drank like they did, that people didn't know they were an alcoholic. My children never had a doubt in their mind, nor anyone else who knew me well. But the one son did not speak to me until I was 3 years sober because he really didn't believe. I had said so many times, I'll never do it again, and I would do it again and again. But I'm very close to all of them today. And I often hear people say because their parents were alcoholic or their mother or they were raised by a drunk that they can't do this and can't do that. And I no longer believe that. My oldest son has an MBA degree. My youngest son has a PhD from Yale. And my daughter has her PhD from the University of Wisconsin. So, and they were raised by a drunk. Who they had many fathers. So, you know, it can be done. I'm very proud of my children today. Not because of their education, but I'm proud that they're honest, decent human beings. And my daughter came into Alcoholics Anonymous 2 years ago last May. And she's very happy that she doesn't have to go through what I went through. And then, after I was here about 5 years, I used to always open my talk saying, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or get married today, and for me that's a miracle. And then I screwed that up, you know, I found it necessary to get married again. I did. I met this really terrific guy in AA, you know, one of those AA campus romances we all of us get acquainted with those sooner or later or sometimes. And we went together a couple years and we were married. I took him back to California on my 10th birthday and we were married out there. And he's with me this weekend. We've been married 4 years and it's really the last April and it's been wonderful. God has definitely blessed me with many, many miracles. After hearing those words when I came out of the coma, I am a miracle. I had no idea what miracles were then. And I have seen and witnessed so many in my life and in other people's lives since being in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the greatest journey, the greatest, that I'll ever be on. And every day I learn a little more. Every day I learn how to love people a little more with no expectations. And for me that's freedom and it's joy. And I'm very grateful to the committee for inviting me here. And I'm very grateful that all of you came. Thank you for being here. I love you all.
Assembly, and we had Frank M., our archivist from the New York office, out as our keynote speaker that Saturday night. And so Sunday he had to be on a plane, I don't know, 12 noon or 12:30 out of Midland, and we were meeting in Big Spring, so I volunteered to take Frank to the airport. And they had the elections for delegate, and I took my name off the board, and I thought that it was automatic that my name was off the board for the rest of the day. Well, it wasn't. I went ahead and took Frank to the airport. I missed the rest of the meeting. Later that evening, the phone rang, and somebody hollered, "Congratulations." I said, "For what?" He said, "You were elected secretary." And I had just gone broke in the oil business. I didn't have a secretary. I didn't have a typewriter, and I didn't know how to type. And this was AA at work again, you know. Sometimes God knows better what we're suited for and what we need for our spiritual growth than we ourselves do. I served out that term, and then as luck had it, the person that seemed to be in line for delegacy did not serve, and I was elected delegate from Northwest Texas to the General Service Conference. And that was a blessing I could never have dreamed of, because to be part of that group, the 91 delegates meeting with the trustees and the staff there for 2 years, to be part of that and see the group conscience at work as Bill and Dr. Bob had envisioned it before Dr. Bob died, In fact, that was one of Dr. Bob's last decisions about the fellowship. You know, they said, who do we turn this thing over to? We can't give it to the trustees to run. No, he says, we've got to give AA to AA. And we'll find a way for delegate representation to meet regularly and carry on the business of the fellowship. And so to be part of that process was more than I could ever have dreamed of. And after that, as is customary out in our area, I'm serving my two-year, I'm just about to finish a two-year term as area chairman, which means, again, I'm educated beyond my intelligence in AA. I know too much, so now I'm rotated out, and next it'll be the ashtrays and the coffee pot again. We just rotate and start at the bottom, and it's exactly where I belong. But as you can tell from what I've told you, none of this could have been possible if it hadn't not only been for the existence of the fellowship and people practicing it when I came in, but also for people willing to take the time. They didn't wait for me sitting down at the quiet man to say, hey, I need help. I did not pick up the phone and call the central office and say, send your best 12 steppers out here for me. You know, no, I was going back and forth to jails and terrible places. And they said, come on, there's a better way and we want to show you. And old Bob W., you know, just Bob to this day, he calls to make sure that I'm not drinking and that I'm practicing my program. And I try to do that to the best of my ability most times. I have learned slowly to come to a daily reliance on a God of my understanding. After only 9 years, I rejoined the church. You know, I'm a slow learner, but I'm not saying that's important to anybody else except to me. But once I was able to get rid of a lot of old ideas and prejudices, why I joined a church there in Midland, and we're bringing along our family. The relationship with the four children was restored. We've sent several of them to college. We've still got, by the way, three in college, in addition to my four. And I mentioned Mary Ellen had two boys. In 1983, her younger sister passed away of breast cancer at a very early age. And a year later, the husband died. And they had two fine boys. And one of them is Matthew, who's here with me tonight. And Matthew's in the Navy here in Jacksonville. If it hadn't been for Matthew, I'd have been late tonight. So it just takes everybody to get me there on time. And Matthew's younger brother, Andrew, is the delight of our life. He's the last one at home. He's just starting the Midland Freshman School in the ninth grade. And when I walk into PTA, they all stand up. They've been seeing me for too many years with all those kids. But Matthew and Andrew just joined right in. We had two more brothers in the mess. And I'll tell you, try to feed and raise and house and have fun with that gang has really been something. Mary Ellen's quite a mother. She says she runs a dormitory there. And there again, we try to keep God in the middle of our relationships. And we let those children know exactly where we come from and why we're here. And it is our responsibility and it's our privilege